Oh, we're going to do it under seven, then let's lock it up. But since we're the time we get that one, so you get in one. So you say time when we start, stop it, time to have it today's. And took up the first chart previously in the way, which I put it to him, but there's only one file on there, that an EXE file, isn't there? No, there, that's the chart. There's only one, as far as I know.
It's not recognizing the drive. Try another USB point.
Yeah, because everyone's only going to look at the screen.
Okay.
Let's see if we can get it to work. Okay, so thank you for coming. Our purpose in gathering is very, very simple. It's to speak about Krishna Katha. And there are benefits of speaking about Krishna Katha, but the easiest way to understand it, the benefits, is that it's completely natural. Natural in the sense that because we're Mama Yavang So Jivaloke Jiva Bhutta Sanatana, we're all part of Krishna. Krishna is the absolute truth, Param Satyam. And that means that different from the Ishwara, different from the controller, he is the absolute truth. So that means that he's all-inclusive. There's nothing external to him. He has many energies. He's a person, a supreme person, an unlimited person, and his energies are everything in existence. And to define everything in existence, sometimes if you talk to physicists or listen to a physicist, they explain that that what they want to do ultimately is have a TOE. Anyone know what a TOE is? Where is Raj when we need him? A theory of everything. And they want to make it, and they say that the great scientist Albert Einstein was working on this as his final project, trying to understand, make an equation about an inch long, or how much an inch, how many centimeters is an inch?
2.5.
Thank you very much. 2.5 centimeters long, that describes everything, an equation in that way. That's what physics speaks about as their ultimate goal. But we have one that's even shorter. It's Hare Krishna, which means Krishna and his energies. And that is a description of the totality of existence. The Supreme Lord and his energies, that's everything. And the Supreme Lord is Krishna. So we are individual souls. We are part of Krishna. There is nothing. Not this. Everything is part of Krishna, the absolute truth. So to hear about him and to speak about him is completely natural for a soul. Okay, now is our time to watch the screen again. Okay, that's better. This is the natural position of the soul to be in relationship with Krishna. Everyone in this world is looking for a perfect relationship, or to be in the proper relationship with them. And generally, people don't think in terms the essential relationship that they require is their relationship with Krishna, with the Supreme Lord. But that is the essence of what we are trying to do, and that is what life is meant for. So in relationship to speaking to Krishna, in relationship to speaking about the Absolute Truth, Krishna, we would like to continue hearing the prayers of Queen Kunti Devi. These prayers began in the Bhagavatam in the first canto, in the 8th chapter of the first canto of the Bhagavatam. And the Srimad Bhagavatam, in essence, is a description of this absolute truth. It's in the first verse, it says, Param Satyam Dhimahi, that it is a meditation on the absolute truth. And this is to be perfect in meditation on the absolute truth in a mood of devotion, a mood of bhakti, in a mood of devotional service. This is the perfection of consciousness. And this is our greatest aspiration, to be always meditating on the absolute truth in the mood of service. And in one sense, it is just due to our dullness of consciousness that we find this very difficult, because there, again, there is nothing in existence separate from the absolute truth. That's the definition of the absolute truth. So if there is nothing in existence separate from him, then everything in existence is included in him. So when we have clear consciousness, we see everything that we perceive, everything we see in relationship to the absolute truth. And the result of Maya, what does Maya mean?
Illusion
or is not. So what Maya does, or illusion does, it gives us a sense of ourself and everything else as separate from this absolute truth. We perceive things as separate from the absolute truth, and that is the specific function of Maya, to give us that perception. And we are willing participants in Maya because we want to see ourselves as separate from the absolute truth, and we want to see things in existence, the objects of this world, as separate from Krishna, because we have this spirit of enjoyment. We want to ourselves be an enjoyer. Purusha, Bhagavad Gita describes this as Purusha Prakriti Stoli, that the living entity, the soul, the eternal soul, is situated in Prakriti, the material energy, Prakriti Stoli, Bhunte Prakriti Dhan, and he's trying to enjoy those things produced of the material energy. This sort of defines our life. We could say our material life, but that's basically our life. Is Bhunte Prakriti Stoli, Prakriti Dhaniha. And trying to enjoy those things of the material world, trying to make, create, manipulate the world or the energies of this world so that we can be peaceful, happy, and successful. But we don't even know what success is in the material world. If I were to ask each individual, what would you consider your life to be when it was successful? You just answer that question to yourself. What does it mean? Just general answers: a house, a good family, success, having money, having maybe a little bit of fame, or a little in the career, this or that. But then we die. So what happens to our success? We've lost it all. So if we have something and then lose it, is that truly a good definition of success? And then we don't know where we're going in our next life, because the body just turns into dust or ashes or whatever. But what happens to us, that which gives life to the body? What happens to us? Where does the soul go, the eternal soul? So we want to redefine, Srila Prabhupada, some of most of his basic preaching, or his words, his pravachan, was redefining what the purpose of human life is, or defining what the purpose of human life is. And we have to redefine what the purpose of our life is if we understand things, and to take responsibility for ourselves in life. To take responsibility means that don't fritter away our life, just wasting time playing in the sand, just like when the children go to the beach, they make sand castles, or they make little forts and things like that. And what do the parents do? They just watch, but the parents know what's going to happen. And what is going to happen? The tide will come in and everything is finished. But yet the parents, okay, you want to enjoy your little boy, little girl, okay, have fun. But at some point the parents say, now it's time, we have to go home. And then sometimes the children will say, but I don't want to go home. I want to stay here and play forever. But the parents, of course, they don't say, I want to stay here and play forever, but they want to stay there and play forever. They just want to play, but they can't just play because the tide's going to come in. So many other things have to be done. So Krishna in that way watches us, like the child is in the presence of the parent at the beach, and he's sort of waiting till we grow up a little bit. So now is the time to grow up. So the Bhagavatam is meant to help us grow up. It's such wonderful instructions, very, very powerful. It's actually a transcendental literature, not only because it speaks about transcendence and it teaches us how we can also go beyond the material world, but also has a certain potency to it that can lift us beyond matter and can lift us behind our daily boring material lives and put us in a different realm. That's specifically one of the potencies of the Bhagavatam. It instructs on three different levels. Sambandha, what our relationship is with Krishna, with the Absolute Truth, with the Supreme Lord, with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Second level is it talks about the process of attaining our relationship with Krishna. The third level is prayojana, or what is the ultimate necessity, or what is the ultimate goal, or where we are ultimately meant to be. So all three levels it speaks about. So in the first canto, during our little retreat several months ago, when the weather was warm, do you remember that? Did you attend?
No, we
didn't. But the weather was warm. Do you remember when the weather was warm?
No.
No.
Yesterday, I was not there.
Okay. Where were you? Where did you? Okay. You recently arrived.
Yeah.
Okay. But you were somewhere before.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. But I just would like to make a philosophical point. Yeah. So we come here and then we get used to a new place. And then you have to have a new house and you have to so many new things. But you existed before. So similarly, we come into this world and we get used to our new situation. But we did exist before in a similar way. You can confirm or this. Did you exist before you came to Perth? Yes? I thought so. I could tell. Where were you before?
Melbourne.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's colder in Melbourne anyway. At least but several months ago, when the weather was warmer, raise your hand if you attended that little retreat we had. Okay. So we spoke about the opening prayers of Queen Kunti, and in the next week we'll take it to the next step, and then finally we'll conclude the prayers, Krishna willing. I found them in preparation or in studying these prayers. I've read them quite a few times, but each time I was able to become say more deeply understanding them and experience the sweetness of them more each time, especially the end, the beginning and the end, but also the middle. It's so nice too. So we've completed the beginning, but I would like to just quickly review it, and then we'll start in the middle, with the middle. In my own analysis of these prayers of Queen Kunti, they begin in text 18 of the 8th chapter, and they end in text 42, if I remember correct, 43. Okay, how many verses is that? Begin in 18, 43.
36.
36, 24. 24. 26.
26.
Okay, 26. Now you did that without either a mobile phone, a computer, or taking off your socks and counting your fingers and everything. I'm very impressed. Because I found that when I first, I remember it was many, many years ago, I got a calculator, my first calculator. It was my first calculator, but it's not not the original calculator, because this is a joke I made up. Because Krishna used to, he had something called a money mala, which, what does that mean?
Jeweled beads.
Jeweled beads. And with 108 beads. And he had all the cows separated into different groups. And there were 108 groups of cows. So he would, when it was time to go home, he would count the groups of cows to make sure, because he didn't want to leave even one cow behind. So on this manimala, on this set of beads made out of jewels, Krishna would count them. So I say that's the first calculator. Cow calculator. Not bad. You can have it. You can use it. But anyway, that was the first calculator. But my first calculator, I got it when I was living in Hong Kong in 1973 or two, a long time ago. And I remember I got it, and it was such advanced technology in that day, in those days. And I remember doing my addition, whatever, addition and subtraction and this multiplication, whatever I had to do, I did it on this little calculator. And then there were times when I had to figure out addition, subtraction, multiplication or something or other, but the calculator was on the other side of the room. And then when I would want to just figure it out in my mind or write it down, my mind would say, no, I won't do it. You have to go get the calculator. Because these implements, these technological implements, rather than making us more intelligent and more stronger, they actually they make our intelligence and mind stronger, intelligence weaker. Actually, in that sense, they're a detriment. You can do things faster. Raise your hand if you don't have a computer. Yeah, let's do it. No wonder you're sitting in the chairs. Okay, we'll make it even harder. Raise your hand if you don't have a mobile phone. Okay, you're the winner. Anyway, there was a philosophical point that I was going to make, but I can't even remember what it was. So many years using a computer and a calculator.
Number of verses. We started from the number of verses.
Yeah, that's that part I remembered. But in any case, what I would like to do is review these up to the verses that we covered during the retreat, very quickly go over them, so we get a feel for how the prayers of Kunti Devi are progressing. And then we will, Krishna willing, we shall hear one verse of the remaining verses. So it started on verse 18, and we ended on verse 27. So how many verses did we cover in the retreat?
10.
That's a safe answer. How did you do in math? If you answered that,
it's
9 or 10.
The seventh was completed.
Okay. Because your teacher, if I was your teacher, I would have said, okay, D or E. Or something.
Class.
Yeah, okay, there you go. Anyway, you're in the advanced class now. Okay. So in the first verse of Kunti Devi's prayers, and the setting is that Krishna was about to leave. Now, one could say difficult, or one could also say impossible to understand what Kunti Devi is going through, because to feel the separation, or that the person is going to leave, to the intensity, or to understand it to the intensity that Kunti Devi was experiencing it, one has to really be a lover of Krishna. One has to have the experience of what it's like to be in Krishna's presence and to be alive in Krishna's presence, conscious of Krishna's presence, conscious of what all attractiveness means, all beautiful means, all intelligent, all wealthy, just every quality that attracts every person Krishna possesses to an unlimited degree. This is again the meaning of the Absolute Truth. He's the reservoir of everything wonderful, the source of everything wonderful, and he possesses all wonderful qualities to an unlimited degree. So how do we conceive of what unlimited is with our limited finite minds? Very difficult. So it is difficult to perceive what Kunti Devi is experiencing, but this is the process of becoming and more advanced, for advancing in Krishna consciousness and devotional service, by hearing the prayers and the words and watching the actions and dealings between Krishna and his devotees. We get a glimpse of in reference to the devotees, we get a glimpse of what their consciousness is like, because what their consciousness is like, what is in their hearts, becomes expressed through their mouth, and we get to hear their prayers, their words. And by hearing their words, we get to touch them on a deep level, and that touch can affect our consciousness. So this gradually becomes revealed what Kunti Devi is going to say. So she begins in text 18, and Krishna has just placed the Pandavas and Queen Kunti as the emperor, Samra, of the world. There was such a huge battle that was really orchestrated by Krishna in one sense, but in another sense it was really orchestrated by Duryodhana and Dhritarashtra. But in a more absolute sense, it was orchestrated by Krishna, because to remove the burden of the earth, in the words of the Bhagavad Gita, to remove many of the demonic elements that were inhabiting the earth. So Krishna had successfully placed the devotees, powerful warrior, king, qualified noble devotees, in as the rulers. And then, his mission having been accomplished, he was heading back to Dwarka. He'd been away for quite a while. So the residents of Dwarka, because Krishna was going there, and they had been missing him, they had been feeling, we use the term feeling separation in Sanskrit is vraha bhav. They were missing Krishna so much. It's like the only thing you can compare it to is, in one sense, there's many comparisons, but when you haven't eaten for a long time, and finally there's a food to eat, or if you haven't breathed, the absence of one's breath, and then finally you can breathe, it's just so nourishing to one, and what one feels like when one can't breathe. If you can't breathe, and you can have so many wonderful things before you, but what will you do with them if you can't breathe? So similarly, the residents of Dwarka, when Krishna was away, were experiencing their lives as empty of meaning. What is life without Krishna there? And suddenly they heard that he was coming, returning. The battle had been won and he was returning. So there was the hope of their life was returning to them. So this is actually described, his return to Dwarka is described in the 11th chapter of this first canto. But here, while it's the resonant of Dwarka's opportunity to have their life returned to them, Kunti Devi and the residents of Hastinapur's time to dread what was going to happen. What is the Hindi word for dread? You must have some idea. Okay, but you don't know. How would you say dread in Hindi?
Bahut kharab. Bahut kharab.
Bahut kharab. Okay, that's
some, not exactly.
Not exactly.
Bhayankar.
Bhayankar.
Bianca. How would you translate that in English, just generally?
Bianca, like horrible, dreadful.
Yes, horrible and dreadful. So they were feeling. Do we have an agreement on that word? Yes, you know that word?
Yeah, I know.
Is it okay?
Yeah.
So you didn't know. So now it was the residents of Hastinapur. They were beginning to have that dreadful feeling that Krishna's leaving. And Kunti Devi, for Kunti Devi, the mother of the Pandavas, this was intolerable for her. So she placed herself before Krishna, or Krishna actually come to see her, and her words now are her prayers asking Krishna not to leave. So you have what a situation. You have the residents of Hastinapur and Kunti praying Vyankar. Did I get it okay? Yes, close enough.
Yes sir, very good.
Because I have a good teacher. So their feeling is dreadful, and then on the other side, the people of Dwarka, the resident of Dwarka, are feeling life coming back to their body. So this is the nature of rasa. And when one's relationship with Krishna is awakened, both the dreadful and the joyful have a transcendental element to them. There are both transcendental spiritual ecstatic experiences, which is completely different from the world of duality of this material world, where one is terrible and the other is wonderful, and one only understands in the material world the feeling of terrible by comparing it to wonderful. But from the point of view of spiritual life, because everything is temporary in the material world, even the wonderful, because it's temporarily wonderful, therefore you're going to lose it, so it's ultimately miserable. So from the point of view of spiritual life, from that perspective, the good and bad in the material world are bad and causing misery. And especially if you have something very, very wonderful like your own. Does anyone have a Volvo car? No, I didn't think so. But if you have your own Rolls Royce and something, it's wonderful, even work. And it's so wonderful, but then you get attached to it, and then it's time for you to leave this world, and you're thinking, oh, my Rolls Royce, I have to leave it behind. And yes, you do have to leave it behind. So from the perspective of spiritual life, good and bad in the material world, there's no real meaning to it. They're all ultimately miserable. And from the point of view of spiritual life, good and bad in spiritual life are all ecstatic. Because in relationship to Krishna, for a soul who loves Krishna, for a person who loves Krishna, there is an unlimitedly blissful experience. But in variety, there's a variety of blissful experiences, and that defines the spiritual world, and a variety of difficult experiences defines the material world. When we're young, I mean not that young, how young is that one?
Three.
Not young is that, because that one, life is very simple. When I'm on mommy's lap, everything is okay. But when we're a little bit older than that, we sort of dream. We have this dream that when I'm older and bigger, and this is going to happen, and it's all going to be so wonderful. My husband or wife is going to be wealthy, beautiful, everything, and perfectly obedient to me, whichever side it's in. And then the children, they're all going to. I don't know what you can say, the children. Well, anyway, whatever you're dreaming they're going to be, they're not going to be that. It's like a dream. So we dream anticipating happiness, anticipating how much pleasure there's going to be when I buy that new car, get that new house. This and that, just dream that these are going to be the source of our pleasure. But they actually, it's the anticipation where the happiness really lies, not in the actual achievement about the desire, the hope that it's going to bring me pleasure. And then we go through life. We go through life just one dream after the next, after the next, after the next, after the next, thinking that the what we're looking for, the eternal satisfaction we're looking for, is just over there, a little bit further, but it doesn't come. So Kunti Devi first in spiritual life, which is what we're longing for, that kind of depth of spiritual life where the relationship with Krishna is so deep that the waves that must come in the material world of ups and downs, they don't affect us very, they don't affect us on a deep level because our relationship with Krishna is so deep. Does anyone know that verse? Pandeji. Narayana Praksabe Nakutastena Bibiti. Lord Shiva actually says this to Parvati, that the devotees, are deep, they're amazing. Because Swaga Pavaga Narakeshu, whether they're in heaven or liberated or in Narak, Api Toyota, it's all the same to them. What could their consciousness be like? That wherever I am, I'm so deeply in relationship with Krishna that those, the externals of my life don't govern my happiness or misery. They don't affect it. That's what we want to strive for, that depth of Krishna consciousness. And such a person is not really in the material world, even though he may be in the material world externally, appear to be in the material world, but such a person who has that consciousness is with Krishna. He's so deeply with Krishna that he's actually, even though he's relating perfectly and clearly with the material world, but actually he's relating to the material world in relationship to Krishna, because as we spoke about in the beginning, everything in the material world does have a relationship to Krishna. Everything, every person, and ourselves. So living in that consciousness is called Krishna consciousness. So Kunti Devi first says to Krishna, Namase Purusham Todyam. Because these verses are so nice, I'll have to struggle to not avoid speaking too much about them. But she first offers her obeisances to Krishna, even though he's her nephew, because she understands that he's actually in the role of nephew, but he's actually the Supreme Lord. Actually, she understands him as the Paramatma, the Super Soul, who is in everyone's heart. And is the, we'll talk about that later, what it means to be the Super Soul. So she says, you are the original personality and are unaffected by the qualities of the material world. You are existing both within and without everything. You are everywhere, inside, outside. But antarbahir vastita, I can't see you anywhere. No one can see you anywhere. You're everywhere, but no one can perceive you. And this is one of the essential issues that's going to be discussed first. Why, in the second verse, in the 19th verse, Maya Javani Katsana, you are covered. Like the sun is covered by clouds. It's not the sun that's really covered by clouds, and it's not that the sun doesn't exist, but it's our eyes are covered by the cloud. And what is the cloud? Maya, illusion. So she's answering the question of why can't I see, why can't we see Krishna everywhere, although he's omnipresent, he's existing everywhere, is because the curtain of Maya covers us. Even though you are eternally existing and all pervading everywhere. Nalakshase mudadrisha, and we can't understand you, the foolish, the mudadrisha. Those who are foolish, so she's also saying that we as conditioned souls are all foolish because although his existence is everywhere, we don't see him anywhere. So it's not like an innocent, it's a foolishness What's the difference between innocent and foolish?
Innocence is lack of knowledge.
And foolishness is?
Having knowledge but still not.
Okay, that's.
The right thing.
But you mean every fool has knowledge? Maybe not. No. So there's. It's like. Maybe
misuse
being.
Of knowledge.
Huh?
Misuse of knowledge, the fool is.
Well, maybe he doesn't have knowledge. And, like a fool can not have knowledge too. So in other words, one could also say the quality, one of the qualities or characteristics of a fool is that he has no knowledge, or if he has knowledge, he's not using it, which means, practically speaking, he doesn't have it, or misusing it, which is even worse. So there's different, it's different degrees of the same problem. If one is actually fixed in actual knowledge, no one would either call him ignorant nor foolish. But the mudadrisa, the one who is the foolish observer, as Prabhupada translates it here, the person, he cannot perceive the lakshanam, the existence of the Supreme Lord. And then Kunti Devi gives an example, nato natya dara yata. Just like if there's an actor on stage, or in a video or in a movie, and you may know him personally, but due to his makeup and due to his costume and the way he's acting, he appears to be something completely different, and you don't even recognize him. So that is, even though he's a well-known person, he's unrecognizable. So that's the example that's given. We don't recognize Krishna even though we know him. We have a relationship with him. We know him. But just like an actor is on stage in a different costume, he may not be understood or recognized something. So she's saying, so you, even though you are there, and then she says, well, who does know you then? If the people in general don't know you, who does know you? Because that gives a hint, and she's going to move to this point. How can he be known? Because that's the real question of life. How can I, as an individual, awaken my relationship with the Supreme Lord so I can actually be so alive in that relationship with him, so much in relationship with him, that I actually have bhakti or love for him, so that I can live my life in devotional service, and then when leaving this world, that I can hold tightly to him and go to him. That's sort of, to develop that, to cultivate that is the purpose of life. That's what Prabhupada has taught us, that that is the responsible use of human life, to make that attempt in one's life. So she begins saying, well, who knows you? Who can know you? And then she'll say something very humble. She says, Tata Parma Hamsanam Muninam Amalamanam. Those who are pure-hearted, completely unattached to the material realm, those who are uncontaminated, not touched or controlled by passion, those who are not controlled by ignorance, who are situated in this world, but in a very, very detached way with purified consciousness. Bhakti yoga vidana tam. You've come to give devotional service to these extremely qualified people. Like when there's an advanced class in the university in quantum theory or something like that, then you have to have a certain degree of development in physics to enter that class and make any sense out of it, practically speaking. You have to have a qualification before you can understand something that's extremely deep. So similarly, she's saying that these people are so advanced, and you've come to give devotional service to this advanced soul, but then she says, Kitam Pashemi Histriya. How could people like me, who don't have these qualifications, I'm a mother of 5 children and I'm attached and entangled, this is her viewpoint about herself, and how can we know you? How can people like me know you? And that's the question. And Then, in a subtle way, she will answer it. Krishnaya Vasudevaya Devaki Nandanaya Cha Nanda Gopa Kumaraya Govindaya Namo Namah. So she sings these wonderful names of Krishna, and they all have very sweet meanings, and they're all in relationship with devotees, because Krishna likes to be known, he likes to be called a name in relationship to his devotees or activities that he has done, which are all in relationship to his devotees. Nanda Gopa Kumaraya, you are the beloved son of Nanda Gopa. So as soon as he hears that, he remembers Nanda Gopa, and he remembers Vrindavan, and he remembers Mother Yashoda, and he remembers the cows, and he remembers his friends, and he remembers the Vraja Gopis. And in this way, his heart becomes very, very, very melted in the affection for these very, very deep and most loving relationships. People have the most souls, or individuals who have the most intimate and loving relationship with them. So she offers her obeisances to them, and she's telling us that this is the way to have a relationship, to advance towards this high state of consciousness, this purified and rarefied state of consciousness, subtle like anything, so that we can be in relationship with Krishna continuously and constantly, by developing bhakti, by developing devotion, and by knowing, understanding Krishna's relationship with his devotees, and developing our own relationship with devotees. And then she offers prayers in so many ways, glorifying him as in comparing him to a lotus. Namo Pankajanam Bhaya, Namo Pankajamalane. So, because Krishna, everything about Krishna, all that one says, that a lotus has many qualities that Krishna shares with that lotus. The lotus is very, very soft, and Krishna is very soft, and the lotus is very fragrant and pinkish, and Krishna's feet are like lotus feet, and his palms are very pinkish. His eyes are lotus eyes. So all these different wonderful characteristics of the lotus shared by Krishna. And lotus is called Pankaja. That means born, and Pankaj means mud. So the lotus is born out of the mud, and yet it is so wonderful. And it is, when it's in water, and its leaves have a waxy surface to them, so the water never touches the lotus leaves, and the water and the lotus itself are situated out of the water. So in this way, Krishna appears to be in the water of this material world, but he's actually above it. And great devotees also are known. When we refer to a great devotee like Srila Prabhupada, we would say his lotus feet, and his feet were very soft and pinkish also, but we'd say lotus feet because it appeared that he was walking in this world, but when you dealt with him, it was clear that he was not really of this world. And when you see any videos or movies of him, it's clear that he's not relating with the material world in the way that a person who is in the material world, he's not affected. He's on his mission, his consciousness is fixed, he's clear, he's doing what he's doing, but he's not entangled in the material world in the way that ordinary folks like us, me, are entangled in the material world. So we say also he has lotus feet. It seems like I'm just going to get to the end of the introduction, and tomorrow we'll start the actual verses. and then he explains in two verses, explains how Krishna has always protected her family. And the implication by her doing this is that now you please you've protected us so far from this and that. There was a fire and you protected the whole family from the fire. From Bhima was eating poison cakes and he was protected by you when we were exiled in the forest. Speaking of the Pandavas, all the stories and from the Mahabharata, you protected us. But now you're going to leave us. And you are like our life. Our life's breath. And what happens to the body, to the person, when his life breath leaves him? So you've protected us on hundreds of occasions before, but now you're going to leave us? And that will mean we have no life. This was the feeling of Kunti Devi Sonas, loving devotion. And she was the queen mother at that time. And her sons were the kings and the princes and everything. But this is how she felt without Krishna. And this is what's going to, in the ending of her prayers, she's going to make these points very, very clear. And then she says something that in the last three verses of the verses that we spoke about at the retreat, 25, 26, and 27, she says something quite astounding, because in times of difficulty, Krishna was always there with them, her and her sons, and protecting them, being with them. But who wants difficulty? I mean, it's not like anyone really wants difficulty. But she's saying that I prefer the difficulties with you present than to be in the best of all situations without your presence. So theoretically, we can understand that. Yes, we say she loves Krishna. Great devotee, Krishna always protected them, he's so attractive. But just try to glimpse how deep her love for him is, that she prefers a calamitous situation to being without Krishna, because Bhavato Darshanam Yatsyat, and here's the first level, Apuna Bhava Darshana, because by having your darshan, by having your association, by being with you, then there will be no more bhava-darshan. We will not see repeated birth and death. It's over. Our material existence is over by your presence. Apana bhava-darshan. No more birth and death by being. So this is not only true. She's not speaking, she's speaking philosophy, but in an unphilosophical way. But the philosophy is, I say unphilosophical, because when Krishna leaves, and he does leave, she's just going to be thinking, Krishna, where is Krishna? When will I see Krishna? When will I see Krishna again? And then in that, she's going to be experiencing Krishna. So when one has love for Krishna, as we were mentioning before, whether one is with him or not with him, one is with him. And when one has no love for Krishna, as we were saying before in a different way, because we're not separate from Krishna, when we have no love for Krishna, even when we're with him or not with him, we're not with him. Like I've had that happen to me so many times, that I walk into the temple, I'm thinking specifically about Vrindavan, but my mind is elsewhere. And I really had an experience of this once in Jagannath Puri. But my mind is elsewhere, and then I'm there, but my mind is completely somewhere else. And then when I walk out of the temple, I say, okay, what color clothes were Krishna Balaram or Radha Shyamasundara wearing? And I have no idea. So was I really there even? So yes, on a certain level I was there, but on a certain level I was certainly not there. And similarly, that there's nothing separate from Krishna. Krishna says, Bhumi Rupo Nalovayu, but because we don't have love for Krishna. Kamsa was standing right in front of Krishna. Mm-hmm. Kaliya was trying to kill Krishna. He tried to kill Krishna right in front of Krishna. He saw Krishna's beauty, tried to kill him. So did he really see? No. So when one has no love for Krishna, has an averseness to Krishna, that whether one is with Krishna or not with Krishna, one will not be with Krishna. And when one has love for Krishna, whether one is with Krishna or not with Krishna, one will be with Krishna. So the real object of our life is to develop love for Krishna, to develop the consciousness that puts us with Krishna continuously, only. It's such a wonderful concept, and this is what we're meant to. We should strive for this and learn how to. We should try our best, use our life properly to try our best. So on one level, she's saying, we prefer the calamities because with calamities we're with you. And that means we won't be with birth and death. But then she takes it further and says, you are so easy to approach. And this is a very, very important. All these verses are so wonderful. But Janmai Swaya Shutashibi Naiva Arhati Abhidatambai Tamakim Sanabhosana. You are very easy to approach. But if I am thinking that my birth is wonderful, and my power is wonderful, and my opulence is wonderful, and my beauty is wonderful, and my learning is wonderful, then I'm going to take shelter of those external things and not take shelter of you. I don't really need you, Krishna. So a person who has those things as their shelter and their goal, Naiva arhati, they don't abhidatumbai, they cannot actually call out, and because they can't call out to you, you're not there for them, because Krishna is right there always, but he doesn't show himself because we don't want him there always. He's the star of the whole show, so to speak, and you know, and I want to be the star, so he can't. I want to be the central person, so I can't make you leave because you're everywhere. So instead, could you just put this little cloud of mine in front of my eyes so I don't have to notice that you're everywhere? So that, and therefore, immediately we're in the material world, and that material consciousness precedes our being in the material world, and material consciousness is preceded by this desire to not be with Krishna, and that is preceded by, I don't want some unfortunate choices that we make in our life. So she says that you are the property of those who really have no shelter in the material world, but have you as their only shelter. And such a person can call out to you with fear. And then the final verse is, she offers obeisances to him, who again, namo kinsa navittayan, navittago navittaye, atmaramaya yashantaya, karvalya pate namah. She glorifies him, offering obeisances to him, again saying that you are the property of those who don't, because you are not involved in the material world in the sense of it being matter. It's all spiritual energy from the point of view of the spiritualist. From Krishna's point of view, it's all his energy. Like the example is given, like the prison house and the university. So both from the government's point of view, they have to support them both. And they're both required, and they're both good, and they give money for both. But from the criminal's point of view, one is good and one is bad. So from Krishna's point of view, and by the way, it's the university is good and the prison is bad. But from Krishna's point of view, they're just departments, governmental departments, so to speak. So the material energy, Krishna doesn't have an affection for it as the material energy, doesn't want to enjoy it as we want to enjoy it. And those who are in that mood with the material energy, and Krishna becomes conquered by them because he's already self-satisfied. He's most gentle, and these are the words she uses to glorify him. Okay, so we'll stop here and see if there's a little time for questions. And tomorrow we'll begin with the next set of verses. We'll read the next one. Thank you. Any questions or comment? Yes.
I've got a question, maybe a silly question, but it hit me. And when you said that something about the car, I was saying, well, what if you're thinking of your car when you're dying? You know, you're so attached to your possessions, your car. Well, what would you come back as?
Well, if I know in the old days when I was growing up, there were Volkswagens, and we used to call them Beetles. So if you happen to have a Volkswagen, and you're thinking of your beloved Beetle, well, it could be like that. Or if you have a Holden, it depends what you're holding on to. And if you have an ambassador, you know, none of you have ambassadors here. You know, they stopped producing ambassadors in India. But you might come back as an ambassador to Australia. Or if you had a Rolls Royce, I don't know what you... Anyway, you don't have that problem worrying what you come back with if you're attached to your Rolls Royce. What kind of a car do you have nowadays?
A Nissan.
A Nissan.
Yeah. Nissan Bluebird.
What color is it?
No, it's one of the makes of the Nissans, a Nissan Bluebird.
Do you have a Bluebird?
No, I have a white bird.
Okay. Well, there you go. You won't come back as a Bluebird. There's another joke that we have is that when, say, if you're driving a car, we don't hope this happens to anyone, and someone, especially if you have a new, bangs into you, and especially if you have a new car. Has anyone ever seen a new car in India that didn't have bumps and scratches? Have you? You?
Yeah.
Huh?
A couple of these, yes.
Before, well, it's still in the showroom. No matter what, how good a car you have, it's always going to be scratched. So So especially when you have a new car, if someone like crashes into it, you get so angry, and you get out, and you say, "You hit me," because the sense of self is projected onto something that is not us. So in the case of a car that is called a hung car. That's funny, yeah. You don't understand. Hung car means a full sense of self in Sanskrit. But a hum means I, car. It's a little bit of a cultural fusion. A hung car, my car. It also means full sense of self. It's pretty clever, yeah?
Thanks for explaining it.
Yeah. Listen, you can use it. If you can understand it, you can use it. It's yours. A hung car. Okay, any other questions? That was quite a question. Thank you, Tana. Yes.
Probably you might answer this later, but I've been having this question that Kunti Maharani could pray that let calamities come, because when calamities are there, then Krishna is with us. But he was physically there with them, with Kunti Maharani, with the Pandavas.
Yeah.
But for us, it's difficult to say that let calamities come, because for us, physically, we don't see Krishna there. Yes, we might try to increase the intensity of our chanting, but we don't physically feel the presence of Krishna.
Mm.
So how can we apply these principles?
Well, the principle is that if one is in heaven, swagalok, and having great delights in life, or one is in a very, very pleasant, perfectly happy situation, then there's such a tendency to forget Krishna. Even for a pious person. So the resonance of the higher planets, they think the mix of happiness and distress that occurs continuously in this world is a better situation for remembering Krishna. So in that sense, when everything is very, very, very good, there's such a tendency to forget Krishna. But on the other hand, if one has a depth of Krishna consciousness, which Kunti Devi did have, when there's difficulty, there's an immediate turning to Krishna, in all difficulty. But that's depth of Krishna consciousness. And then in whether Krishna is physically present before one, or one can personally, subjectively perceive Krishna's presence, by turning to him very, very deeply, we will perceive Krishna's presence because he comes. So that's the experience of the devotees. Because he's already there, that's half the point. He's already there, he doesn't have to travel far to get to wherever we are when we call out to him. So the problem isn't that he's not there, the problem is that we don't call out to him, we run from him. We tend to, unless our consciousness is deep and mature, we tend to run from him, even in difficulty. So what will we do when it's time to leave this world, at the time of death, when there's so much difficulty? We're surrounded by difficulty, pain, can't breathe, this and that. And that's what practiced in life, to take shelter of him in difficulty. Ante Narayana Smriti, to remember him. And it will be very difficult to do it. But as soon as we actually do it, take shelter of Krishna, he's there. So what do you think about that answer?
We have to develop the perception. The problem is that we don't have the perception.
Right. Yeah, and what is the perception is a result of bhakti. Mm. So we have to develop bhakti. Because we can't develop the perception independently of bhakti. Mm-hmm. So sometimes we try to develop the perception intellectually. You know, now how am I going to see Krishna everywhere? How is he in the fan? How is he? Okay, I think that Bhumirapo, according to the Bhagavad Gita, he's the metal, he's the paint, he's the electricity. So we can approach it intellectually, which is better than not approaching at all, but it's because we're thinking about Krishna, but really it has to give birth to bhakti, then it's completely natural to perceive and think of Krishna. Is that okay? So bhakti means our relationship with him, which is natural, which is loving. So to always turn to Krishna in good times and in bad times means that there's a lot of bhakti there. To not be dismayed by the bad times, but to turn to Krishna and yet deal practically, and not to be elated with the good times, but turn to Krishna. It's very good consciousness. Then, Krishna even says that, tasyaham sulabha parta. Whoever sees me everywhere and sees everything in me, I've never lost to him, nor has he ever lost to me. But that takes bhakti. You can't say, from now on, I'm going to see Krishna everywhere and everything. I mean, you can't say it, but from my experience, it doesn't work. Okay, any last question? Did you have a question? Yeah.
No, I haven't.
Oh, okay.
Thank you, Bhavati. No. Okay.
Did I use too many Sanskrit words?
No, they turned over my head, but... No, I've got quite a bit out of tonight's session.
Thank you very much. Will you be able to come tomorrow? Do you have time?
I can't commit. I'd love to, but I can't commit at this stage.
Okay. Well, anyway, you're welcome.
Thank you very much.
Okay, if there are no other questions, yes.
You mentioned about happiness in anticipation.
Happiness. I mentioned happiness. Anticipation is what the happiness is rather than the fulfillment. Yeah.
That's if you look at it in terms of having material desires.
Yes, yes.
Could you switch that, you know, in terms of spirituality? Would that equal to separation?
Anticipating being with Krishna.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought of that, but yes. There's different kinds of separations from Krishna. One is before one's ever met him, but this is advanced stage. And one is having met him, and another one is, and then missing him and then being separated. Another is when he's nearby, another one when he's far away. So they all have different flavors to them. So anticipating being with Krishna. And then there's also one verse that says that eagerness, which is something like anticipation, that's the real wealth that a person has, the eagerness to be with Krishna rather than what's the opposite of eagerness?
Neutrality.
Neutrality or aversion. Mm. So often someone wants to say that the class is over. Okay, it's over. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Thank you very much.